This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
All right, folks, here we go. Welcome into another edition of the Bartholomew Town Podcast. It's Bill Bartholomew here with you for another episode. Today, we welcome in from the Latino Policy Institute at Roger Williams University, the director thereof, Marcela Betancourt. And this is an important conversation today, folks. It touches on a number of highly relevant issues to the moment, but also zooming out just to the big picture, not only on questions of immigration or what we learned about healthcare disparities and other disparities through COVID-19, but some of the lived experience of some members of the Latino community here in Rhode Island and beyond. So Marcela is actually someone who I'm kind of surprised hasn't been on the show yet. And if you don't know who she is, then this is a great opportunity to learn about her and the Latino Policy Institute, a great operation, so to speak, here in the great state of Rhode Island. Okay, folks, remember, for daily digital content, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Bill Bartholomew, and go ahead and join that Bartholomew Town Podcast Facebook group. I know Facebook, it pretty much sucks. We know that. But at the same time, the Facebook group, it's kind of cool because we can have these discussions in there. It's sort of a one-stop shop for me to pop different versions of content, live streams, so on and so forth. And we have some fun in there. That's the Bartholomew Town Podcast Facebook group. Okay, without further ado, let's get to it. Marcela Betancourt of the Latino Policy Institute.
My name is Marcela Betancourt. I'm the director of the Latino Policy Institute. We are part of Roger Williams University. We've actually been part of the university for 15 years. Our 15th anniversary fell on a global pandemic year, yes. Which was really fun. but we have, we've been around, you know, since then. And our main mission is to really kind of elevate and simulate public policy to objectively kind of examine and communicate the evolving experience of Latinos in our state. And I say evolving because it is really important for the Institute and for myself that we acknowledge that all Latinos don't look the same. We're not a monolithic community. And it is something that I try to highlight in all the work that we do.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I mean, that is something that is so often in like mainstream conversations, sort of just simplified, highly, highly oversimplified. I mean, the political spectrum, the experience spectrum, the income spectrum, the any number of spectrums varies from person to person. It has not, you know, it doesn't really matter your ethnic or other background. And so that's, like you say, that monolithic presentation is something that is actually kind of gotten pretty ugly at times. And people make assumptions that, well, you know, a good example that I heard recently was this stadium that's coming to Pawtucket, the soccer stadium. And I kind of got into a little debate with somebody that was like, well, you know, the Latino and African community will pack out the stadium. And it's like, well, wait a second now. I mean, that is what? Yeah. You know, where are you getting this sort of approach?
Exactly. Like, how are you assuming that we're all going to like soccer? And yes, this is, it's an incredible thing. I think it's a really interesting conversation to hear from people of the misconceptions that they have about the Latino community, especially because there's so many generations of it, especially in our state, right? Generations of Latinos have been here and they don't all speak Spanish. Like I, you know, that's a huge thing that I think, you know, for someone like me, who's a first generation, that's an incredible weird thing to learn. And for, you know, people like my parents who were immigrants, I think it's a really big disconnect, but it's understanding that the generations are different, that our experiences are, our race, like, you know, what we look like is incredibly different. And that comes with a lot of issues. The stadium, that's a really great example.
Yeah.
Some of us really like soccer, but some of us don't.
Yeah. It's just like any other population. I mean, the only one that I can see that would fit the, oh good, they're going to pack out the stadium, are kids who play organized soccer and their parents taking them, or like some kind of like, you know, graduated from college 2-3 years ago. They're still here and they're looking for an activity to kind of like scream and shout and drink.
Absolutely. Exactly. And, you know, and disclaimer, like soccer is also really great. So America just needs to get it together and get in with the bandwagon of the rest of the world.
Yeah. And it's so true. And it's like one of those American centric conversations too, because you know, in other countries, of course, soccer's king, and it trickles down all the way to the youth level, where, frankly, even from an equipment standpoint, you know, if you have a ball that is remotely round, that's all you need. And you know, you can have a lot of any kind. You can have goals made with shoes, all the way up through a fabulous facility, and the game can be played and shared, and it brings people together. And we could go on and on about it. And it's like, it is a very American-centric position that it's somehow a second-tier sport.
It absolutely is. Thank you for saying that.
Oh,
yes.
Of course. Where did your parents immigrate from?
Yeah, so my mom came here from Colombia. We came here when I was 12 years old. And here she met my stepdad, who is also from Colombia, and he had already been here for 20 plus years. So that's where we come from. It's the place where I call home still. It's the part of my other heart. And yeah, it's a beautiful place.
How often do you get to go, or have you been?
Yeah, so I you know, when I was younger and in college, when in college you take it for granted they get 2 months off of school. Yeah. I used to go very often. And now as a responsible adult, sometimes it's a little harder, but I actually just got to go very recent for some medical reasons. And while sadly it's during a pandemic, it was a really great, you know, it was great to see my family. I don't have family in this country. All my family is back home. And so it's a great time to go every time.
That's such a specific experience as well, that a lot of people will never be able to understand, that especially in Rhode Island, where sometimes you have quadruple unlimited number of generations that go all the way back to like the Mayflower or something like that, or the Mayflower II. Mm-hmm. And it's like an experience to be first generation and be so disconnected from your family and your culture. Yeah, there's WhatsApp. Yeah, we've got a situation now where you can communicate with people fairly regularly, or instantaneously, but it must be lonesome at times and sad.
Yeah, it definitely is. It definitely is. I think, you know, the older I get, the more I commend my mom for, again, she was a single mom and she was undocumented when she came here. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, she came here because this country presented better opportunities for me in education access, and for workforce for her, even if it was going into a factory to earn minimum wage. And so I, you know, we were so far away from our family. I grew up there in Colombia with tons of cousins and family. And so it was a very normal thing. And it's part of, you know, my development of who I've become. But coming here, it's a very isolating country in general, I think. That's even to this day, it's been a really interesting thing to kind of like fight with. It's as America, we're very individualistic, and coming from countries where that is not the case, where you have to think collectively, is very difficult. And so your family so far is incredibly hard. But I tell my mom all the time, you know, it's coming to this country must have been the hardest decision she had to make, but it was the best gift she could have given me for several reasons. And I think, and the people who do it in general for in whatever, you know, in so many different levels, people who either are fleeing violence or just want a better life, they're the bravest people, right? And it's, you know, data and studies show us like immigrants are incredibly resilient. Like them and the first generation are more likely to succeed and want to work hard and do all of these things because they're resilient in general. Just the trip here, it makes you resilient. And so I am incredibly grateful for everyone who over the last few centuries has chosen to immigrate to this country.
Yeah, and you're right. There is a huge difference between the North American, I guess, or frankly, the United States, maybe Canada as well, approach to things, and like countries of South America or West Asia. You know, an Arabian Sunday lunch can include, you know, cousins and uncle, you know, it's like humongous amounts of people that become part of the immediate family. Mm-hmm. Whereas here it never gets to that point. And I feel like there is I don't want to say coldness, but there's like levels or layers of family that are drawn here in the US that perhaps in other places, those layers don't exist, and you get closer to people who are not necessarily a brother or a father. You know what I mean? Like this is just observational and conversational based on experience, but you know, that seems to be pretty consistent.
Absolutely. I think it's the idea of, and I don't think this is specifically wrong, right? But in this country, we're taught that you have to succeed. Like your success determines so much, and you can do that by in different ways, right? Education or other things. But in, you know, in some of our countries, success is what you do for your family and how you're bringing your family along and what you're doing collectively. And so I think that there's problems with both, right? There's the trauma in both. And but I think there's a lot to take from both ideas that is really important. But it's a really interesting and sometimes still very difficult thing to kind of like deal with. But again, so that makes me a different type of Latina. It makes me, then I can't compare ever my experience with somebody else. Yep. But it's part of the interesting conversations.
Right now we face in this country a number of different, very specific challenges. Of course, we're coming out of COVID-19, hopefully coming out. I mean, if we look at the global picture, that's certainly not the case. We had 4 deaths yesterday here in Rhode Island alone, and it's not as if this thing is over. But we've got vaccines rolling out here in the U.S. and other parts of the globe. But during COVID-19, there's no question about it that there was a high rate of impact that the Latino community experienced. That was something that brought awareness to the lack of access to healthcare, lack of brick and mortar facilities, sometimes transportation, sometimes even translation issues, and perhaps some suggested even skepticism with the infrastructure of the United States federal government. How have you and how has the Institute sort of wrapped your collective heads around this and figured out a way to, you know, move forward? We hear about the new normal. What will that look like based on what we've learned or what the general population has learned, I guess, in the course of COVID-19?
Yeah, no, that's a really great point. I think the thing that we continue to highlight, and I know others have as well, is what we're seeing, you know, since COVID-19, it's just really an example of what we created for decades. Mm-hmm. Right? What you mentioned of the inequities in housing and housing access, healthcare access. These are things that are not, they didn't just come out of nowhere or because of the virus. They were there. And so the thing that we keep highlighting is a lot of these issues should have been prevented years ago. So last year, in end of September, we actually had a report called the Latino Impact Plan, and we underscored that. In the last recession in 2008, 2009, there were all these changes and investments that were made in the federal level and the state level. To, you know, at the beginning of 2020, Black and Latino communities in our country still had not recovered completely from the last recession in 2008. Yeah. Right. And why was that? It was because, similar to how you mentioned, so there were cultural issues that were not thought of. There were like gender and racial issues, intersectional issues that were never thought of or really addressed. And we have yet another, you know, health pandemic and economic crisis that is just kind of exposing it all over again. And so the thing that we are saying is this is once again the once in a lifetime, hopefully a lifetime opportunity to change that. The things that we did not do back in 2009, such as investing in a real way into what housing infrastructure means, into housing access. It means how, like, every single human being needs to have a home. For months, we could not be outside, yet we asked, you know, and people who were not housed at the moment were the first ones that were exposed. It also exposed individuals who had to be, you know, were trying to be kicked out of their home. In general, there was a lot of issues. The fact that healthcare, you know, is even being mentioned today as something that, oh, it is a right that we should have. This is a basic thing that every person in this country needs to have. Other countries that have less population and are less developed, and make sure that every person in their population has access to healthcare. That isn't like, why are we staying behind? And so it is, especially, and then the other thing is, one of the biggest investments that especially Rhode Island made after the last recession was a really big investment into workforce development. Yet, what does that workforce development look like, right? So who did it touch and who did, you know, who was prioritized? We still have, you know, individuals of color and younger people, especially and older people who were not touched by that, you know, workforce development effort. And that is something that we need to do. We need to make sure that we're acknowledging that there are gaps in how our federal and state government is doing work. Who are they reaching out to? Why are we expecting people to do things in a certain language, in a certain way, in a certain cultural manner, when it is in our best interest as a state to make sure that every individual that can work and wants to work is able to.
Totally. I mean, yeah. And work at a living wage with adequate, you know, whether it's benefits that are employer created or we kind of restructure the system from the top down. And there's this like fear of socialism or something like that, that people that are opposed to this keep bringing up. And it's like, guys, you know, you're just so off on this one. If you look at, first of all, never mind the humanity element of it, which is like, to me, basic, like, yeah, we should be providing healthcare in an equitable manner. I mean, that's not a radical statement. You know what I mean? That's something that frankly, Republicans, Democrats, independents, libertarians, whatever, should all agree on. I mean, come on. But then there's also the economic factor of it that people just don't wrap their heads around and how expensive it can become when we don't have equity in healthcare because we're constantly playing catch up and we're seeing the impact in areas where it takes people out of the workforce that then that slows down GDP, that slows down taxation opportunities. I mean, it's just a weird conversation because it seems like so obvious no matter what your worldview is that this is something we've got to dial in. Yet people say, oh, that's Bernie Sanders. And that's like, you know, the same people who want to like light Providence Place Mall on fire and, you know, whatever.
It is. I think it's just really ironic because, if I were a billionaire and if I were Jeff Bezos, I would want, in order for me to have even more money, I would want to make sure everyone that works for me is able to go to the doctor when they're sick. Because if they're sick, they can't come to work. Because if they don't have access to childcare, they're going to quit their job and I'm going to lose production. Because if they're not paid a great rate, then they're going to leave, right? Aside from the terrible things that I may do as a terrible billionaire. But that's just in general. And so I think that that's just such an ironic thing that we take. And so, for example, I think some of the investments that we have to do are that, right? Like it might just seem crazy today, but 2010, you know, even 10 years down the road, we need to have an economy in which we are actually able to be able to work in different spheres. So one of the big things that we keep highlighting, and so the Economic Progress Institute has this, shared this data a couple of years ago, by 2040, Latinos are going to make 57% of the workforce, right? Yeah. And so that's 2040. That's still 20 years from now. That means those kids are in high school right now or middle school or in elementary school. How is our state investing in those Latino youth to make sure that in 20 years, our economy is going to be stable and is going to be, or even just thriving? And it's that, it's how are we going to make sure that by 2040, we have healthcare for people, that we have childcare that is accessible for people. Because I don't care what party you are part of or what your political ideology is. If you have a child, you should be able to have that child, you know, have great education, no matter where you live, be taken care of. Your health should be taken care of. Like, this should not be a political ideology thing. This is a humanistic thing. And so I think it's a really interesting conversation that we need to have and make investments today. And that's either by utilizing some of the federal funding, but also we're part of the Revenue Coalition. We think that ensuring that, you know, the wealthy Rhode Islanders should be taxed just a tiny bit more so that we can bring over $100 million into the state. That can kind of create some of this work.
All right, folks, this is getting real. The time for talk is over. From iron workers to engineers, business owners to biology teachers, Rhode Islanders believe in the power of offshore wind. Together, we're cleaning the air and creating jobs right here at home. Our goal of 100% renewables by 2030 is in sight, and the future is bright with Rhode Island a real leader in America's emerging offshore wind industry. So, what makes you a Revolution Wind believer? Join us at revolution-wind.com/itsreal. That's revolution-wind.com/itsreal. Let's go. There's another looming crisis that's been going on for decades upon decades, and one could argue it's been going on since anyone who's not indigenous to North America started showing up here, and that's the immigrant quote-unquote border crisis right now.
Yeah,
it's become highly politicized, and look, no matter where you sit, again, pro-Trump, pro-Biden, think the government's horrible, think the government's great, whatever it is, there is an issue there that's a humanitarian question, and then there's also a question of just, you know, how do we move forward with a system that is appropriate? A lot of people don't realize just how difficult it is to become a quote-unquote legal person in the United States, never mind the pathway to citizenship. And is it making that simpler? Is it something else? Like what? Where do we go from here to make that a smoother operation, so to speak, to create this, to get rid of this backlog? And by the way, it also favors people who are wealthy enormously. If you have whatever the number is in your bank account, you can basically buy your way into the United States.
Exactly.
How do we correct this?
Yeah, no, thank you. And you know, it's one of the hardest questions for so many reasons, right? It's a very personal thing, but also it's just a really difficult political thing in general. I think that when we look at the crisis right now of like millions of humans who are right now trying to get into the United States through the Mexico border. So we're only looking at a specific population. So that is actually a small percentage of individuals who migrate to this country. That is the first thing. People just think that that's the only way people come to this country. It is not. It is a very small percentage, and it actually has decreased. The people who are there, so many of them are fleeing violence. They're fleeing hunger. They are fleeing governments who are corrupt. And I think the United States and other countries we're seeing this in Europe as well.
Yep.
In parts of Asia, is wealthy countries actually have an incredible responsibility, and also kind of it's in their favor to make sure that economies and countries around them are stable. And so one, I think it is the responsibility of this country to make sure that they are listening to what the governments and individuals from those countries need to help in some ways, but also the individuals that are fleeing there. It's a great reason to leave. Like this is a United Nations thing. They should be welcome into this country. If they are here, you know, then they should have accessibility to be able to work and live in a place that is healthy and safe for them. Why? So let's go back to the economic portion that we were talking about. It is great for our economy. It is individuals that if they have the ability to work, that they will bring an economic growth for whatever state and city they live in and for their families. So I think that in general is a really important thing. And you know, even the individuals who say, well, we can't afford it. We're already over capacity. We can't help everybody in welfare. One, that is not how things work. You should look into people who are undocumented do not have access to so many things. Nevertheless, it does not mean that they actually pay taxes into be able to support these systems that other people are being able to take advantage of, and they never will be able to take themselves. And then second, what you mentioned of, so what do we do? I think the path to citizenship or just to legalization is incredibly difficult. I can tell you that by experience, for my mom, it was really she was only able to become a legal resident when I turned 21, because I'm a US citizen. So I was able to kind of do a process with her. But there are people in this country who will have been here for decades and will never become legal citizens or just legal residents. And it is incredibly expensive, as you mentioned. People that have thousands and millions of dollars from other countries can come here and just the process is a lot easier for them. But depending on where you come from, that process is not as easy and it is incredibly expensive. And for many, there will never be a path to citizenship. And I think that that's really short-sighted of this country. And again, no matter what political party you're in, having individuals that are able to work and give into your economy should be something that we want, because they take advantage of us anyway, right? Look at the census right now, right? So just Rhode Island was able to keep our two seats. Other states were probably able to gain seats or keep their seats thanks to undocumented people. And so we should always be thankful to individuals who are in our states.
Yeah, no, there's no question about it. And poverty or I guess wealth division, you know, it knows no national or physical boundaries. There are plenty of people who are from wealthy global north countries, British people who are in this country. They don't have sometimes two nickels to rub together when they get here to the United States. And for them to become a citizen here is extremely difficult. Canadian people, I mean, there's, you know, it's this conversation has become so, it's kind of gross the where it's gotten to. It's kind of like, ooh, you've oversimplified it. You've made it xenophobic and it's so counterproductive that, again, it's not a political thing.
Exactly.
And that's what's weird about it to me. It really isn't. Yeah.
Because, you know, and I think, I always think it's really interesting people who say, well, my grandparents came here legally. They did it the right way. And I just want those people to tell me exactly what the right way meant back in the like 50s. Or like 40s, because that was you came, however, and thank you for being here. We needed workers.
Yeah.
So should we not be saying that today? Because right now we have, that's the thing. I think we choose to have undocumented people as long as we don't get to see them. And as long as they work and do all these other things and are really in this marginalized group, we're fine having them as long as we don't have to look at them. But then we become offended at the fact that they would want to become one of us because according to us, they didn't do it the right way. And I think that's just a really ironic thing because, as you mentioned, it's the story of how difficult it has become. It is incredibly hard. It can take decades. It can take decades for you to become a legal resident if you do it, quote unquote, the right way today.
Last question. Something that's been around for or an issue for a while, but I really started to tune in on in the last year or so is the underrepresentation of, frankly, non-white communities in Rhode Island's media. Yes, we have Latino Public Radio. It leans very right, and it is representative of a certain segment. Again, politics are not – there's no unique politics to somebody who comes from any country or something like that. We have my colleague Michelle San Miguel, who is a Cuban-American at Rhode Island PBS, and you know, we have Podair. You know, there are some satellite operations that are highly nuanced or quote unquote ethnic news sources. But by and large, you turn on the news, you read the Boston Globe, Providence Journal, listen to WPRO or the Public's Radio. What's going on here?
Yeah, I'm so glad that you brought that up because similarly, like you, it's one of those things that I'm sure I saw, and I don't think I really honed into it until I actually became part of LPI. So, as I mentioned, we are part of Roger Williams University. We're an organization within it, and I've had the great opportunity to meet Professor Paula Prado, who is a journalism professor and is among other amazing things that she does here at Roger Williams. And she is Brazilian and she speaks multiple languages and she's this amazing woman. And she talks about this a lot of, you know, the lack of representation when it comes to her media. And I think that what happens is, I think it's what's happening in a lot of other professions. One, I think, how are we investing in individuals to make sure that if they follow this profession, that, you know, large organizations, like you mentioned, right? Like the new, you know, a newscast organization, the Boston Globe, Projo, how are they investing to make sure that they're paying equitably to individuals that have different language, living language abilities, and come from different ethnic and racial backgrounds? Are they paying them equitably to their white peers? Are we making sure that there are enough programs within universities or colleges locally and regionally? Are they actually reaching out to communities of color, right? I know many people who went through communications, but that's different. Like, how are we making sure that they're going through journalism and all these other things? It to me, it's a similar connection to the conversation that we're having about the teacher of color pipeline, right? When we talk about that pipeline is, well, people are interested, but maybe the pay isn't enough. Maybe the programming isn't actually connecting with communities of color. Because if you're going to teach me only the way of how to be a journalist in a white-centric place, then as a person of color, that's going to be incredibly difficult for me. But it has to be an investment. It is 2021, and that we do not have people who are of Asian descent or Latino descent, of other, you know, of other ethnic and cultural backgrounds in, you know, in our newspapers, in our radios, and in our TVs. It is shameful. And I think it is part of the lack of investment in some of these companies as well.
Yeah, it definitely is. And there's gotta be a way. It's gotten to the point where it's hard to take the mainstream media seriously on certain stories, even as well-intentioned. And by most of the people that work in the Rhode Island media are amazing people. They're dedicated journalists. They're empathetic, objective. They present all of these qualities, and it's nothing even as a slight to them. It's just more of like, what's going on? Why is this the model or the mold that we constantly see here? I get that Rhode Island is a largely white, middle class, et cetera, community. And I'm not saying that that's, and I also understand that those outlets are reaching people in the suburbs by and large who are buying the vehicles that they see advertised or the mattresses that they see advertised. I get it. But that's not to say that people of any other background aren't doing that or don't fit that demographic. So it's just this, we're at this transitional point where I think you're right. The system has got to catch up. Yeah. Communications. I studied that when I was at URI. That is not an acceptable, that's not enough to get you a gig at the Boston Globe. We'll put it that way.
Exactly. And I think, you know, one of the other things is, because when we look at it and you're right. And I'm very appreciative and I really respect, you know, journalists that we have in our state and all the media like yourselves that are able to kind of like highlight all these really important things in our state. But it's also at the end of the day, like who's also in the background, like who's the boss and what do they look like? What does the representation look like even in that sense? Because as we see in most industries is if leadership does not represent what communities look like, then that's why we do not have enough. There's also not a lot of women. We have awesome women reporters and, you know, journalists, but to be honest, I think that they need to be highlighted even more. So I think that's an issue in itself. And so I think, what does the leadership look like in general? What does leadership look like at these media companies? And what does it look like, again, at the educational institutions that are hoping to promote that young people are able to come into these professions, because that's also a really big part of the problem.
Yeah. Well, thank you for what you do, because the Institute, Roger Williams as a whole, is obviously, you've got yourself on the pulse of this, and it's been, it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out here over the next decade in Rhode Island and globally, frankly, but zooming into this region, this state, it's going to be interesting. I think things are turning in the right direction. A lot of people would disagree with that and say, oh, you know, we don't have the workforce we need in general. The Providence school system's bad. We've got a lot of issues of social injustice. We've got problems with this, with that. But I think the underbelly, people are becoming more and more aware of these issues, and they're starting to figure, how can I address them no matter where they live, no matter what their background, and understand that, yeah, we need to make some radical changes here fast.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We need to make some investments into every part of our state. And LPI will be here for the next 10 years to make sure that we poke at people until they continue doing the right thing.
At HealthSource RI for Employers, we provide access to health insurance to more than 1,100 local businesses and nonprofits, and 96% of them renew through us every year. Maybe it's our choice of 19 different health plans, our 10 years of customizing solutions, or our one local team of dedicated experts helping employers find quality health insurance. See how our numbers stack up for you. Learn more at healthsourceri.com/employers.